We're going to talk about revolutions in the pipeline. Have you had the Yogi Berra quote yet?
Go ahead.
Yogi Berra, the great baseball coach, said, of course, that it's very difficult to make predictions, especially about the future. So we shouldn't really be held to our predictions, or our forecasts, perhaps, sometimes. It's not easy. But we're going to look forward, particularly in the world of technology, and perhaps implications of innovations that are coming, may yet come. And to help us do this, Diane Coyle, economist, author, deputy chair of the BBC Trust, all-round good egg, will lead off for us in a moment, and will be followed by Ben Hamsley, writer, author of, I must give it a plug, I didn't give Diane's book a plug, let me give Diane's book a plug, of GDP.
A
Brief and Affectionate History of GDP.
Pre-order now.
Available next year. Ben, however, has written 64 Things You Need to Know Now for Then. And that's out already, and that is available.
Yeah.
They're both available. You can 2-for-1, maybe.
We could do a deal.
And Ben is also polyglot and polymath and international and high-tech and contributing editor of Wires in this country.
And has learnt how to do the flying trapeze.
Could you rig something up here?
It's a bit small.
You haven't got the headroom. I could fit in. You can't. Revolutions in the pipeline. Scenario planning, forecasting. It's a venerable skill and art and hard to do well. And in particular, economic forecasting. Remember, Diane, what J.K. Galbraith said about economic forecasting, that it was invented to make astrology look respectable. If you're asked to forecast, do you get a sort of sick feeling in the pit of your stomach, or do you actually brace yourself and give it your best shot?
I don't do forecasts. I mean, the rule of thumb is that you can say what's going to happen, but not when. You can only say when or what, but not both at the same time. Mm. But I don't do economic forecasts. I was going to talk about this concept that's become quite widely known about how hard it is to think about the implications of new technologies. The sense that we overhype them short term and we get stock market bubbles, but we underhype, we underestimate what the long-term effects are. And this was first written down in the economics literature by somebody called Paul David, an economic historian, in a 1991 paper for the OECD called The Computer and the Dynamo. And he was talking about the paradox identified at the time that there were computers and everybody was hyping them, but they didn't seem to be having any effect on the economy or on the productivity figures. And so he looked back at an earlier example of a technology that had been incredibly hyped at the time, and that was the electric motor, the dynamo, and talked about why it took so long to change the economy and change productivity. And the basic technologies were dated back to the 1870s, and they were spreading quite widely through the United States in the early 20th century, but there was no impact on the productivity figures. And what he observed was that actually, to have that kind of impact, there's a lot of additional change needed too. If you have a steam-driven factory, what you build is a tall building with a steam chimney, and you've got one engine. They're big things. They take a lot of capital. And you have one engine driving all the machines, and so you stack them up on floors above each other. If you've got a motor on each machine, you don't need to do that. And what's more, you don't get the benefits of an assembly line unless you change the kind of building and you spread them out so you can do the traditional assembly line, one task in a sequence after another. And so until you've built whole new factories, you don't get any productivity benefit of having electric engines rather than a steam engine driving your factory. And also you need to build a network to have electricity distribution. If you've got large factories, you want to have large agglomerations of workers to go and work in them, so you start building suburbs. So it turns out that to get the full benefit of electrification in production, you need a whole huge amount of infrastructure investment and social innovation and political change, and it's all very large-scale stuff. And his estimate was that it took 50 years from the start of the takeoff of the adoption of electrification in factories to getting the full productivity benefit. And it wasn't actually until after the Second World War and the mass assembly era that you saw what the full effects of a late 19th century technology. So that's the short-term overhyping. And he called this technological presbyopia, which is this middle-aged eyesight term where you're both short-sighted and long-sighted at the same time, as some of us are discovering now. The thing about the long-term underhyping is that there are lots of dependencies in this. So it depends on getting that infrastructure done. It depends on long and variable lags. You're talking about a non-linear complex system, very hard to forecast. And what that means is that we're going to get somewhere inherently unpredictable, but it's going to be somewhere very far from where we are now. And one example would be the railways. And a famous economic historian called Robert Vogel said, if you look at the effect on GDP, it looks kind of small, actually, so maybe the railways weren't all that important. But what railways did was enable urbanisation, because for the first time, you didn't need to have all the cows living quite close to where the people were. You could bring milk in on the milk train. You could bring food in from the countryside into the town. So that was a very big social consequence. One of the social consequences of electrification was feminism and the washing machine. Hans Rosling has a lovely TED talk at the moment about the washing machine being one of the most important innovations of the 20th century because it liberated women from housework. And that's quite a big consequence of electrification. So this is where we get to the long-term underhyping. It's really hard to predict, inherently hard to predict, what those long-term consequences are going to be. Now, these are called general-purpose technologies in economics, and the speed of diffusion of this kind of technology seems to have increased over time. So for the phone to get to two-thirds of American households took about 45 years. It took about 20 years for electricity in households, about 15 years for the internet, about 10 years for smartphones. Smartphones in the developing world going even faster, about 5 years in some countries. Another historian has looked at the pure economic effects. If you look at the effect on GDP growth, how does this set of general purpose technologies, internet and communications, compare to steam or compare to electricity? And although the absolute numbers are small, the differences accumulate over time because of compound arithmetic. And he's saying that this is a much bigger story than steam or electrification for the economy in terms of long-term growth. So that's quite a big thought. That is, we're looking at something that ultimately will be bigger in its effects on the economy and on these wider social phenomena than the Industrial Revolution. So that's quite big, I think. So I wanted to end with a few questions that we need to ask about this new wave of technologies that Ben is going to talk to us about. One is, what investment is needed alongside it, and who's going to do that? Where's the money coming from? What infrastructure is needed? Infrastructure is something much bigger than getting a business to invest in a specific commercial technology. What are governments thinking about doing, and are they thinking about spending enough money on infrastructure? Even within a company, the estimates are that the amount of investment that you need to make in things other than the technology are much bigger. Erik Brynjolfsson, who before he got frightened by robots, did a lot of work on how businesses are using them, said that companies need to invest about 10 times as much in intangible investments in the organisational structure of the firm, work practices, compared to the amount they spend on software and computers. So it's a big deal. And the technology, the productivity impacts technology vary greatly between firms. And it's the ones who reorganise and change working practices very thoroughly. They get 25-30% productivity gains, and a lot of companies get none because they don't make any changes. So one set of questions is about investment and who's doing it. Another is about what social innovations mean that these technologies are going to serve people. In the historical examples, new technologies over time benefit consumers. So there, of course there are individual companies who do very well, but it gets translated through competition and continuing imitative investment and innovation. It gets translated into benefits for consumers. And what's called the producer surplus, the surplus profit in the short term, gets competed away. The one exception being finance, where innovation hasn't served consumers. We've got, obviously, a big issue about economic equality. The gains so far are not serving consumers. So I think that's a big question. And these technologies are not going to be taken up and spread if they don't start serving people. And then the final set of questions is about the politics of it. And even in infrastructure investment, there's a lot of politics. But I think there's a lot of politics, too, in these issues of control. And the fashion, I think, in political science is to say, The economy is being driven by cities, the technologies are putting more value in face-to-face interactions, urbanisation is speeding up, the successful cities are the very big cities. So the fashion is to say that it's all about city mayors or some sub-national kind of politics. So there's that question, city regions, how does that change the picture of national politics? But the other question that interests me, and economists don't talk about nearly enough, is that a lot of this is in the illicit economy, in the shadow economy. I mean, some of it in a perfectly straightforward way, which is that we don't count a lot of what's happening with new technology companies because the statistics aren't set up to do it. And in just the same way that in the factory age, the national statistics measured how many different types of sheep we exported because they were geared up for agriculture, we've still got statistics that are geared up for the old structure of the economy, not the new structure. But half of globalisation has been illicit. Illicit multinationals are really big business. And I think there's just a really big set of political questions that I'm no expert on, but I'd love to hear what other people have to say about that. Over to Ben.
Well, could I just ask quickly, what do you make of the big numbers, the big claims that are made sometimes by businesses for innovations? And should we take ladles of salt with them? I mean, but the implication is that long-term we can't know about the value of future efficiency savings or new ways of working because it's just far too soon if we're talking decades before the impact is felt.
Yeah, well, we don't know the specifics, but what we call growth is actually innovation. It's the new products that come along and the great welfare benefits that go along with that. There was a programme in 2000, in 1999, called the 1900 House, where they got a family to live as an Edwardian family would have done. And the reason the experiment nearly broke down was that the wife couldn't bear not washing her hair because shampoo hadn't been invented in 1900. So you've never sit in a room like this and say, here's the new shampoo, but actually growth is all about innovation. We just don't know exactly which ones they are.
That's a thought for the day, isn't it? Growth is all about innovation. True. Thank you. Ben, before you collapse with flu, help us out a bit with some glimpses, tantalising or otherwise, of what we'll be asking for Christmas in years to come.
So that's a good question to start with. There's, when we're talking about technological features stuff, there are really two ways of looking at it. There's the standard way, which is shiny products. So if you look at the vast majority of, for example, technology coverage, it's usually magazines. There's a picture of there's a girl in a bikini on the front cover holding a phone coquettishly. And it's all about the next shiny thing. And there's a whole school of business-related forecasting for the effect of technology, which is based around a single narrative around new gadgets or new boxes of stuff, which is usually based around a thing called Moore's Law. So Moore's Law, if you, I'm sure everybody knows it, but if you don't, Moore's Law was an observation made by Gordon Moore, who was one of the co-founders of Intel, who realized in the early 60s that roughly every 18 months, the number of transistors on an integrated circuit will double, and thereby roughly the computing power available for a specific price will double. And so therefore, roughly every 18 months, computing power for a specific price will double. And this has been true since 1964, I think, and it continues to be true to this day, and we think more or less will be true for another 20 or 30 years. And that has an all sorts of very interesting and exciting and very sort of thrusting and masculine excitement about it, because it has various effects for business. So one of them would be that if you identified something that might be your enemy that currently isn't very good, it's going to kill you in about 5 years' time. And there are many, many, many industries that have seen this happen. So Kodak is the canonical example of that. Kodak invented digital cameras. And they invented the digital camera, and it was like 0.1 megapixels, so it took a digital picture that looked like sort of that painting, basically. And at the same time, they were making Kodachrome, which is the most beautiful transparency film ever created, and it creates the most beautiful photography that anybody had ever seen. And so the Kodak board went, digital photography, we're not doing that, we're going to just keep making film. The day that Kodak went bust, Instagram, which at the time was a company with five employees, which makes an iPhone app that takes pictures that look like Kodachrome, was sold to Facebook for $800 million. Kodak had totally missed the point of the sort of Moore's Law narrative, which is that computing power doubles every 18 months, and so we're going to see these new technologies which inevitably are coming down the road to us and will inevitably destroy us or radically disrupt our industries. And that started off with blue-collar workers, with robots and so on, and we're starting to see this happening with the learned professions. So IBM have got a supercomputer that's called Watson, which famously played on Jeopardy for a few weeks and won quite a few games of Jeopardy live on television. It's an artificial intelligent big supercomputer. And over this year, they've been feeding it with medical documentation. It's now, the last time they talked about it, it's about 50% accurate in a medical diagnosis. So Moore's Law, you could easily say, well, in 5 years' time, Watson will be just as good as your regular family GP. And in 10 years' time, it'll be an iPhone app that's just as good as your regular sort of GP. And certainly for lawyers, for many parts of the law is effectively a big flowchart. Watson is going to kill an awful lot of, you know, conveyancing and solicitors and things like that. Most of that is nonsense that could be done by a computer, right? So we're seeing this sort of Moore's Law-driven innovation that's going to come along and destroy us all. But that narrative... Sorry, all the lawyers.
Cheer up.
All the lawyers in the room are like, really?
It's good while it's not
working. Yeah, yeah. And in fact, you could say that the defensive... reaction to that from the legal profession would be to create incredibly Byzantine regulation. Mm. If you could create regulation which was so weird that nobody could possibly program it into a computer, then that's a great self-defense mechanism. Go for it, you know. Now,
or just program the answer you want people to hear.
Or indeed, you know,
happen in finance with credit rating.
Exactly. So you've got this. So you have this one narrative which is very technocentric. And it's technology driven, and it's almost as if it's a rule of a law of nature that this constant doubling of power will come along and do all of this change. But what we see when we look at that is that in a very autistic Silicon Valley engineer way completely disregards human nature and culture. And what we're starting to see now is the realization. A couple of realizations. One, that culture itself and the cultural reaction to technology has to co-evolve with those new technologies. And sometimes it evolves slower and sometimes it evolves faster than the technologies. So, as a good example, it took us about 20 years to realize that you shouldn't have your phone on in a restaurant. And in many places you still don't. You know, that idea hasn't caught on yet. But there's a certain cultural norms and etiquette evolves much more slowly than technology does. And there's great historical things about you know, when electric light was invented and commercialized by Edison, there was a considerable amount of advertising they did in newspapers, which were pictures of ladies in drawing rooms with parasols because they were convinced that electric light was going to ruin their skin in a way that gas light didn't. You know? And so there was this thing, they would all hold parasols indoors to shield themselves from these terrible aging electric lights. And they had to have apply a social and cultural change to that to match the technology. But what we're starting to realize now, I think, is that technological change contains within it an embedded cultural and political set of values. And that technology, and certainly internet-based mass social media-style technologies, are in many ways the political beliefs of their creators, rarefied in a digital form. And we're starting to see this very strongly. So, for example, Facebook is an inherently political design. To its very core, is the political beliefs of Mark Zuckerberg made flesh, as it were.
The privacy is over bit.
The privacy is over bit. Yeah. So Zuckerberg has if you read anything he's written or listen to him talk or have a conversation with him or whatever, he has this thing which is. A very, very fundamentalist belief that privacy is immoral. in fact. Because, and Google has very similar beliefs as well, which is, it's not that we want you to give up your privacy in order so that we can make money from you, but Google's belief is, if you give up your privacy, say for example your medical records, then Google, with all of their digital tech, with all their sort of big data crunching technologies, will be able to take that data and cure cancer with it. They might make a load of money as well, but they'll cure cancer with it. And by you deciding you don't want to be part of that, you are effectively immoral. Like, so privacy is theft is another phrase that you start to hear a lot in Silicon Valley and amongst those things. And so what we're starting to realise is that every bit of technology has an embedded culture within it. And this is, I think, a new reaction. So I should imagine pretty much everybody around this table at some point in their lives has had a BlackBerry. Now, a BlackBerry is a reification of the political belief that email is more important than anything else in the universe. Right? You have a BlackBerry, and if it's the difference between reading your inbox, you know, clearing your inbox or reading a bedtime story to your daughter, the BlackBerry says it's your inbox, right? And the uptake of that technology is the sort of mimetic transfer of that idea into corporations. So if your corporation gives you a BlackBerry, what they're effectively saying is, you are now our slave 24 hours a day. Right? If you're issued with a BlackBerry, that's what that is. It's not a phone that you're given, like you're given a company car. You know, it's a cultural invasion, and that's what we're starting to see is an understanding of that, which leads me onto the sort of finalish bit, which is, when you're given these new technologies and you realize that each one has an inherently embedded culture and inherently embedded politics to it, it enables you to step back a little bit and say, okay, if we're recreating the world with these supposedly massively transformative technologies, it gives us the opportunity to reconsider what the win condition is, to use a sort of computer gaming term, which is, And as I'm sure Diane will talk about as well, there are many economies around the world who are starting to say, well, okay, growth kind of didn't get us anywhere, right? Shareholder value, yeah, that was a bit of a thing. And, you know, it didn't really work out. It worked out very well for a lot of people. It didn't really work out for many other people. So maybe our win condition isn't using technology in order to make venture capitalists incredibly rich and associated trades. Mm-hmm. But instead, our win condition is to use technology to create a better way of life, or happiness, or well-being, or romance, or serendipity, or inspiration, or poetry, whatever it is, and maximize for beauty. I'll give you an example of this, and then I'll shut up. There's a big trend at the moment for a thing called smart cities. Mm. Smart cities are it's a sort of a generic term for the idea that, given Moore's law, and given the fact which makes things very, very cheap, sensors and connective devices are very, very cheap. So you could go to a city and you could fill that city with sensors for all of the public services. So every bus has a sensor on it, every street corner has a sensor, you know, every bus can tell the internet where it is, every street corner can tell you what the temperature is and how noisy it is and how many people are walking up and down the pavement, and you could pull all this data off the city. And you can then expose that data to people's phones, which will enable people as individuals to optimize their life in the city. So imagine you could go onto Google Maps and you could do a pavement pedestrian density over the next few weekends. So you want to go Christmas shopping in central London, and you could look at it and you go, oh my, you know, Oxford Street's a complete nightmare, I'm gonna go around that way. Right. And everybody doing that, the idea is that it sort of optimizes the city, and many cities are doing this. And I did some work in a town in Denmark called Aarhus, which is a beautiful little town. It's about 300,000 people, and it's a college town, so it's about 300,000 incredibly gorgeous 19-year-olds.
Yes, it's kind of boring.
Yeah, but it's pretty, right? It's very pretty. And one of the interesting things about it is that not only is it slightly boring, but it also has the highest number of pavement cafes per capita in Europe. It's pavement cafes, as far as the eye can see. Turns out this is true. And bicycle lanes. They bought a lot of smart city software, and they bought it from IBM. And IBM smart city software is made in Austin, Texas. And Austin, Texas, an optimized city, is getting people from the outskirts of Austin into the center of Austin in a car, down a freeway, park as quickly as they can, up to their cubicle, back down again, and out to the suburbs. And that's an optimised smart city as far as Austin is concerned. An optimised city as far as Aarhus, or Florence, where I'm living at the moment, is concerned, or any other sort of European town, there, that the optimization for that is going quite slowly by bike via the best cafe and the one that's just brought the croissants out of the oven, or going, you know, via all the streets where you've detected has the prettiest girls or the most handsome boys, or where the blossom is blossoming that week, or whatever it is. You optimize for beauty or serendipity or happiness. The embedded culture in smart city software bought by the Danish, like by the Danish town council, is it bought from Americans, is at fundamental odds with the local culture that they wanted to benefit. But you can't realize that until you start looking at technological advance in a much wider and more sort of socially conscious way, and realize that digital trends are not fate. That you can actually say, you know what, we're not doing this. And that's a slightly sort of Amish thing. And people, when you say that, it's like it's sort of Luddite, it's Amish. But yeah. The interesting thing about the Amish is that if you go there, and I was in Pennsylvania Dutch territory a few months ago. And it's fascinating. They don't reject technology at all. Uh-huh. They're just incredibly mindful and slow to decide about which technologies they adapt. And after a while...
Oh, so it's not true about nothing after 1684 or whatever?
No, it's like 18-something. But what they do is that new technologies will come along and they'll have a meeting and they'll say, do we want this? What will be the effects of it? And so... Some modern technologies, the electric motor and cell phones to a certain extent and things like that, they go, yes, and we'll manage it. Whereas cable TV or, you know, petrol-driven vehicles or whatever, they go, no, we're not having it. And it's the mindfulness based around a much wider community, which I think we're going to start to see a lot more of. Mm. And people... rejecting technologies, not because the technology, because they're, I'm rejecting the dominant narrative that this stuff is coming along, there's nothing we can stop it. So it's, I think we're starting to see a discernment and perhaps the beginnings of a critical language to enable us to have those conversations. But at the moment we have really nothing other than I'm totally for it, I'm totally against it. Yes. We need a much more interesting sort of almost literary criticism type language. You know, we need a sort of the equivalent of literary theory to come up, but for technology. And that would be perhaps socially much more useful than anything else we can talk about if we're just sort of making up stuff about the future.
I'm guessing also that the Amish, given they debate these things, there might even be variants within the community, although villages to village. There might be a slightly more go-ahead,
yes.
More conservative...
Yes, and then they have their roles within that community as well. So you've got the slightly more go-ahead lot, and they'll test things out, and then they'll go, oh, you know, actually, it was a bad idea. And they get rid of it. And then the more conservative ones can be a bit more smart. Or vice versa, right? You know, then we try this, it works, it doesn't have a bad effect.
So unfortunately, it turns out that the Hollywood version of the Amish in Witness is not the whole story.
None of them look like Kelly McGillis.
Really tragic.
Thank you, Ben and Diane, for invigorating our afternoon so well. Thank you very much.